Black Lives Matter. Those working towards systemic change, united in this sentiment, know this, at least cognitively. Yet there is an ache in the hearts and souls of Black Americans and others of the African diaspora, knowing that, for too long, this simple fact has been, what, forgotten, discarded, ignored? In the poem Harlem, Langston Hughes wrote, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?" What we are seeing in the middle of this pandemic is the aftermath of the explosion of too many deferred dreams, dreams of equal treatment in the face of the law and in the face of our peers. Black people and their allies are rising up, reclaiming the psychic space of too many lost and destroyed aspirations. But there are those who, to borrow a phrase from the hip-hop group Public Enemy, have fear of a Black planet. They respond to our cries with the rebuttal that all lives matter, or, what is perhaps more insulting, given the many deaths of Blacks at the hands of police officers, blue lives matter. These people fear a change in the status quo, a status quo in which young men fear for their lives, a status quo where a Black woman is more likely to die in childbirth than a woman of any other race. These people somehow believe that their racial identities will be erased if others gain equality. Well, to quote a meme from the internet, equal rights for others does not mean fewer rights for you. It's not pie. These folks may rest comfortably in the knowledge that their racial identity is secure, their place in society assured. What Black people want is the ability to know that their racial identities will not be scraped away like chewing gum off a sneaker. What Black people want is the knowledge that their place in society is more substantial than the smoke that clouds the vision of many of our nation's leaders. Now, I'm not here to preach. What I am here to do is tell you how much Black lives matter. One Black life in particular, my own. I used to say, only half jokingly, that I'm pretty white for a Black woman. There seemed to be plenty of evidence for this assertion. After all, my peers in elementary, middle, and high school often told me that I acted and talked white, and I listened to white music. I was never able to double dutch jump rope, and the concept of drill teams befuddled me. And let's face it, if any of my actions would have had my Black card revoked, it would have been the fact that I was a legacy of the mother of all Black sororities, Alpha Kappa Alpha, and I chose to pledge a geeky white co-ed fraternity. But my life was not always such a contradiction. Let me tell you about my early life. I spent the first few years of my childhood with three Black Panthers. I do not remember much about them, except for their names: H. Rapp Brown, Angela Davis, and Huey P. Newton. I do not remember them being particularly radical or having guns. I imagine that their appeal for me lay in their other features, such as their soft fur or their whiskers. You see, Rapp, Angela, and Huey were cats, three of the five that my parents owned when I was born. My favorite was a black and white cat named Rover, not named for any Black Panther that I know of. And then there was Cha-Cha, named after an African student my mother knew in college. While I loved the cats, my true nursemaid was a German shepherd, Malaika, whose name meant angel in Swahili. She was an amazingly gentle dog, and she knew basic commands like sit, stay, and lie down in Swahili. Now, I wasn't born in Africa. This was all going down in Denver. But my mother's minor in college had been Swahili, and she loved the language. I was born just after the peaks of the Black Panther movement and the Black is Beautiful aesthetic. As a result, my childhood memories are filled with visions of solemn African statues and colorful kente cloths, and sounds of Stevie Wonder and Earth, Wind, and Fire. My whole family had afros, and we wore them proudly. Then, things changed when I entered elementary school. I was one of those sensitive kids who had the word wimp written across her forehead, and classmates loved looking for reasons to tease. I was teased for being a crybaby, which made me cry, for having an afro, which supposedly made me look like a boy, for reading too much. By fifth grade, the taunts had coalesced around the notion that I was too white to be Black. By eighth grade, I embraced this identity and had my afro cut off, started dressing in Black, and shrugged off the teasing. From that point on, I submersed myself in white subcultures, such as Valley Girl, New Wave, and Goth. Most of my friends were white. I dated mostly white guys. In college, I let my guard down a little. I allowed myself to buy a CD of the group De La Soul, and I saw them perform in concert with fellow artists A Tribe Called Quest. But when I got married, there was nary a kente cloth in sight. I was a bourgeois bride. If my mother was disappointed in my complete dismissal of my early childhood influences, she didn't say so during this period. She was and is always supportive of me. Things changed for me when our family moved from the suburbs of Chicago to Thousand Oaks in 2006. I was suddenly too Black for anyone's comfort, despite acting white. In fact, it was probably my acting white that allowed me to be tolerated to the extent that I was by the schoolyard parents. I felt wholly uncomfortable in California. Who was I? Who was I supposed to be? Should I continue to act white? Or should I return to my roots? I discovered how very uneasy I had become being an Oreo, Black on the outside, but white on the inside. Having a four-year-old boy and a baby on the way made me realize what I owed my children. Sure, society would ensure that their father's white heritage would enter their education, but their Black heritage was my responsibility. I decided that instead of acting white, I would act like myself. I started slowly, buying on iTunes the Stevie Wonder albums that I had grown up on, exposing myself to the hip-hop, soul, and R&B music I had always disparaged in the past. I played music with a bass beat in the car and tried to convince my older boy, Duncan, that not all hip-hop was bad. We talked race and ethnicity. We discussed slavery and discrimination. Being Black in Ventura County wasn't easy. There was no denying that we got stares. Blacks make up less than 1% of the population of Thousand Oaks, and a multiracial Black family was something to talk about. Then, in August 2014, a young man named Michael Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, by a police officer. His death brought to national attention a movement called Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter started after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who shot a young man named Trayvon Martin in 2012. The death of Trayvon Martin was a dark time for me. For the first time, I truly feared for the lives of my sons because of their race. I sardonically told Duncan not to wear the hood up on his hoodie because I didn't want him to get shot. "Don't worry, Mom, I'm not carrying any Skittles," he responded. If Trayvon's death was shocking, Michael Brown's was downright devastating. It brought to light the true vulnerability of my boys and other Black, Indigenous, and young men and women of color at the hands of the police. Thankfully, Black Lives Matter was out there demonstrating, showing that there were others who were equally shocked by what was going on. Black Lives Matter gave me the courage to truly embrace my heritage. Even though I have never marched with them, they have made me realize how important it is to have people state out loud that Black Lives Matter, especially now when they are treated as disposable by the police, the media, our society, by Oreos like I used to be. One of the tasks I have taken on as a Black mother of sons is to administer the talk. Not the sex talk. I'm talking about the how to stay alive talk. When each boy was 12 years old, I went over with them the basic rules of being Black in America. Treat police officers and security with the utmost respect. Don't run from them. If you are pulled over in a car, make sure they can see your hands. And always articulate your actions before you do them. For example, say, "I am getting my license out of my pocket," before you actually do it. And don't wear your hood up. I have since learned that Duncan has added one to his personal list. Don't play loud music in the car at the intersection. My talk with the boys was not an isolated incident. I highly recommend seeing the movie called The Hate U Give, based on the book by Angie Thomas. Available on Netflix, this film is about a teen girl who lives in two worlds: the white world of her exclusive private school and the Black world of her neighborhood. The film opens with a scene where Star and her brothers are being given the talk by their father. Later in the movie, Star witnesses firsthand what happens when you don't obey the rules of the talk, when her friend is shot and killed during a police stop. A key component of Star's upbringing is the Black Panther Party's 10-point program, which her father teaches her and her brothers. Never heard of it? Neither had I. You see, at some point in my life, I bought into the negative propaganda about the Black Panther Party, thinking they were just violent thugs. I had no idea that the organization provided free breakfast for children, operated community health clinics, and created a comprehensive 10-point program. Originally created in 1966 by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, the program was heavily based in Marxist thought and Black nationalism. However, in 1972, its focus was broadened to incorporate other minority groups. Many of the points in the program were ambitious, yes, but they spoke of the plight of Blacks, Indigenous, and other people of color and were obviously important enough to Star's father that she was taught about them. There is one point that is crucial to the movie, and it is the primary goal of Black Lives Matter. It reads, "We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of Black people, other people of color, all oppressed people inside the United States." It's as important today as it was 50 years ago. How sad that we are still fighting for this. The death of George Floyd this year was a turning point for America. Black Lives Matter has become an international movement. While I cannot march with the Black Lives Matter movement, I am doing what I can. At work, I've created an anti-racism book list, and I am working on a social justice research guide. Personally, I myself have changed. I have become more immersed in Black culture. I consciously follow Black thinkers and writers on Twitter and aim to amplify their voices. I celebrated Juneteenth for the first time by watching the Watchmen television series, which uses as the impetus of its story the destruction of the Black Wall Street area in Tulsa in the 1920s. I even have a subscription to a mindfulness app on my iPhone that is by and for Black, Indigenous, and people of color. What I've learned in the past 14 years is that not only do Black lives matter, but this Black life matters. I'm reclaiming the culture that I was raised with and trying to help my sons be aware of their heritage. Black lives matter. My son's Black lives matter. My Black life matters. May it be so.